Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. On the second hour of today's show, I've got some material I'd like to run through with you. I'd like to start off with a look at Julian Assange. It's been a while since we've talked about Mr. Assange on this show. Of course, he's been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy for almost a year now. And the situation under which he is forced to exist is incredibly difficult. He's in a very, very small space with no natural light. He's effectively a prisoner. But he has a much worse fate hanging over his head if he were to step out the door, or if he were to go along with the Swedish extradition. There is a very strong likelihood that he would in fact be extradited to the US and possibly end up in a dungeon somewhere similar to the predicament of Bradley Manning. The Bradley Manning trial is gearing up, and it is going to be a big show trial. It is going to be a big deal in the US. The powers that be in the US are determined to crush this the phenomenon that allowed that very, very famous leakage there of the Baghdad massacre to occur. And I think it's basically to send out a message to scare people, to scare potential whistleblowers. Of course, the media has been playing a double game with Julian Assange. He's certainly been propped up to a large extent, and it appears to have garnered a lot of support from the media. But at the same time, the very spurious allegations against him, which never even amounted to charges, have never been really properly investigated by the Western media. And they continually talk about rape and rape charges, and there was no even allegation of rape. There are no rape charges. There are some allegations of some form of impropriety that may have occurred in Sweden, but of course it's all blown out of all proportion. But the real reason why he avoided the extradition, why he sought asylum in Ecuador, is simply the fear, which is justified, as we shall shortly see, that he would be indeed extradited to the US. And I have here an interview from the American journalist Chris Hedges, recently conducted with Julian Assange in his hideout there in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. So I'm going to play to you that interview in full. It is a little bit rambling, you can tell that Julian Assange is under a lot of pressure. But he makes some interesting statements here about the true predicament he's in. So I do think you'll find it interesting. So I'll play you now the clip from Chris Hedges, and I believe this is published on his website, truthdig.com.
The following is an audio excerpt of Chris Hedges and Julian Assange in discussion at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. For much more, go to truthdig.com.
When you watch all these sort of, all this movement, what do you think they're trying to do? How do they want to try and get you out of here?
I think it's a mess. I don't think that they have. I think there's so many different parties with different interests. It's a mess. The UK wants it to go away, but doesn't want to lose prestige in relation to Ecuador. The situation in Sweden is getting so bad now. The Sweden will never offend the US. Neither the UK or Sweden will ever offend the US. But within that, the situation is so bad now in Sweden.
What do you mean so bad?
Politically, it's the head of the Swedish Supreme Court came out and said that the case is a mess.
Have you had any indication that the Americans have attempted to manipulate the case in Sweden that is...
They don't need to. We have some indications. The ambassador for the UK, Louis Sussman, said beginning of 2011 that they were waiting until after the Swedish case. The independent report,
waiting for what?
What's the US interest in this situation? It's not for my extradition.
No,
he didn't say that, but that's the obvious context.
as the U.S. ambassador to the UK
right.
said early
2011.
Right. That they would.
The U.S. was waiting to see what happened with the Swedish case.
They wouldn't file at the same time because then there'd be two competing extraditions.
Oh, I see.
And so they were waiting till.
I got it.
They would.
There'd be one in the queue, and then the other one would come in, and then it would require the Home Secretary to make a decision, a reviewable court decision, a politically reviewable decision to swap the president for these.
So what they would do is if they're going to actually. If Julian had won a non extradition, they would have likely. At that point, in the UK court filed their extradition.
Or they wait to see I go to Sweden.
Yeah.
So that's what the ambassador said. And then also the independence diplomatic correspondent said in late 2010 that there were already informal talks between Sweden and the US.
The day after you went into prison.
Yeah.
Informal talks between Sweden and the US. So you extradite you to Sweden and then...
And the details were that, I think in that he said it was on conclusion. It would be on conclusion of the Swedish case. And then for the US, where I think the political equation is the most interesting. You have prosecutors in the Manning case that are clearly gearing up for a 12-week Broadway musical.
Yeah.
And where they have their star diva, which is the Navy SEAL guy.
Yeah.
That they're going to make him sing. And it's such a big machine, 141 prosecution witnesses that they've listed.
Okay, I might just leave it there. The quality of that audio is not very good. Obviously, it was done under extraordinarily difficult circumstances. Julian Assange is literally living in a small office, and he has very little room to move. It must be an extremely difficult situation for the man to be in. But I'll give you my summary of the full brief there that came from that little chat, is that, indeed, the evidence that... that Julian has is that, in fact, the U.S. prosecutors were simply waiting to see what the outcome would be of the Swedish extradition. And in the event that that the extradition didn't go ahead, they would then proceed with their own extradition. In the event that the extradition did go ahead, they would then extradite Julian from Sweden. So, in fact, And this was information from the ambassador, not sort of indirect sources. So the situation there is one of a complete travesty of human rights, a complete travesty of justice. A man who is, in fact, broken no laws. He's not a US citizen. He can't be involved in espionage because basically all he's done is exposed information to the general public. It is not espionage. And, of course, the way in which they will try to prosecute him will be insinuating all these things, but in the end probably never getting there. But they've managed to keep him essentially incarcerated now for almost, well, it began in 2010, December 2010, 11 and 12, well over 2 years. The man has been incapable of moving around freely. But, of course, the Manning trial, which is the main event in terms of the actual military trial, is going to be one wherein they attempt to crush this man, Bradley Manning, who, for the good of humanity, gave that information out and released that information. But what they really want to do is make us all, I guess, fear the great empire. Fear sharing the secrets of the empire, and they want to make Assange some sort of sacrificial scapegoat as a warning sign again to any who would dare to simply be a whistleblower or to facilitate a whistleblower. Look, it's so outrageous, ladies and gentlemen. It's so outrageous. It has to be passionately, vigorously opposed. It has to be counteracted. The Australian government is incredibly shameful in the way they have distanced themselves from this whole the saga of Julian Assange. There has to be a real reconciliation here at some point. I don't know what the outcome is going to be, but I do present that information here for your benefits, and of course we'll have the links to that on our website. Now, in the remainder of today's show, I want to move on to a very, very different topic indeed, and one which is rather unusual, hasn't really come up much on this show. It's a subject of gender politics, but it's gender politics from a libertarian perspective and from someone who's kind of sort of an outsider from the feminist movement, a lady, the name of Karen Strawn, and I have a speech she gave here to the Libertarian Society in New York. But she's addressing material and engaging with questions that have been the ground of feminists and radical feminist politics. But she is actually looking at the same subject matter from a very unique perspective, the libertarian perspective, and I find it incredibly fascinating what she's done. And I think it's a really important addition to the sort of the intellectual arsenal we have that has to engage with the set of preconceptions that has been laid down by the PR media wings of our big government socialized system, which has as its underpinning certain socio-political ideological viewpoints which nobody is allowed to question. And there is simply no debate allowed. And of course, the feminist positions on issues about male and female relations are very difficult to deal with when you have a different perspective. Because you can easily be accused, especially if you're a man, of being part of some sort of class oppression against women. But when a woman can present this information, it's much stronger. It's a bit like when an Israeli questions Israel, when a Jew questions Israel, it's a bit harder for that person to be silenced. So I do actually have here a really interesting presentation by Karen Strawn from the New York Libertarian Society. So I'll just kick that off for you now, and we'll be going to break very shortly, but we'll be continuing with that after the break.
Karen Strawn has come here from Alberta. So, you know, I came all the way from Manhattan. She came all the way from faraway province in Western Canada to be with us. And Karen is doing something very different than many people in her area. She's in an area, particularly with discussing issues about radical feminism and gender politics. And as we all know, that's an area that's been co-opted by the left almost exclusively. And when the right-wingers talk about it, it's all, oh, well, you know, they belong at a house, you know, making babies or whatever.
We're just going to break. Do stay with us. A really interesting presentation here by Karen Strawn. We'll be right back after the break. Don't go away. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now.
They say everything can be replaced. Every distance is not near. So I remember everything. Man who put me here. Oh,
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm bringing you here a presentation by Karen Strawn, who is a kind of an anti-feminist, you might say. It's a bit hard to know how to categorize her position. She's a libertarian, that's for sure. But she's really questioning, critiquing feminism. And she's doing so with a degree of intellectual rigor, which I think is very valuable. And it's also very valuable for a lot of men, I feel, who have been disempowered and made to feel that they are somehow intrinsically bad by certain ideological aspects of radical feminism. And she really deconstructs that in this speech. And she addresses a lot of the concerns that I feel about the nanny state that we live under. And it's part of the whole problem. And she's actually got a very important part of the jigsaw puzzle, I believe, in terms of how we unravel the mess we've created with our society. So I'll just hand it over to Karen to continue to bring you this information. And you can get more on this from our website. And I do encourage you to send me an email if you find it interesting.
And Karen is doing something very different than many people in her area. She's in an area, particularly with discussing issues about radical feminism and gender politics. And as we all know, that's an area that's been co-opted by the left almost exclusively. And when the right-wingers talk about it, it's all, oh, well, you know, they belong in the house, you know, making babies or whatever. So, you know, that gets us nowhere either. But Karen is in a particularly wonderful niche. She's talking about gender politics from a pro-freedom point of view. And that is really a wonderful thing to do. So I'm looking forward, and I'm sure we all are, to hearing from Karen Strawn. Thank you.
Okay, can you all hear me? All right. Just a few things that I wanted to say. Thanks to Gary for inviting me here, and I'd like to thank all of you here as well for keeping an open mind. Some of the things that I'm going to talk about might seem a little bit crazy, might seem a little offensive even, but if...
You're in the right place.
There you go. If you hear me out, you might get your back up a little at first, but if you hear me out through the whole thing, I'm hoping to present a different point of view, a different angle for all of you to be able to look at gendered issues, in particular ideological feminism and the influence that it has had on public policy and the legal system, especially in the areas of family law and domestic violence law. So, and maybe you're all asking yourselves, what does gender have to do with libertarian politics and libertarian philosophies? And, you know, the answer to that's complex, but also really, really simple. Gender influences everything. Everything. Especially the size, scope, and decisions of government. On the micro scale, gender will affect the way men and women think, how they feel, how they process their interactions with the world, what motivates them, what influences them, what's important to them, and what incentives are going to affect their behavior and how. It affects how we perceive other people depending on whether they're male or female. It impacts on what we feel is appropriate regarding the behaviors, responsibilities, and roles we expect of others, and the ones that we expect of ourselves. It affects what roles and vocations, on average, a given person is going to find themselves suited to or interested in. And on the macro scale, gender affects the way society feels about people, depending on whether they're male or female. What expectations society has of them, what obligations society is prepared to place on them, how and how much society is going to care about them. It influences whose voices society is prepared to trust on what issues, and affects society's willingness to punish or forgive, who society is interested in holding responsible or accountable for wrongs done, who society is prepared to devote resources to help and protect, and who society is prepared to cut loose. So gender is kind of a shortcut that societies and governments use when sorting priorities. Who's deserving of our help, protection, and support, socially, legally, and governmentally, and who's less deserving or maybe not deserving at all? You know, how should that help be implemented? How should it not? How much are we willing to spend? How much institutional power and scope should government have to involve itself in the lives of its citizens? And, you know, in order to demonstrate the effect of gender on how we think and the way we react to things, I'm just going to quote, make a few quotes. These are probably quotes that you have heard from Barack Obama, from Hillary Clinton, and I'm going to switch the genders and see how you feel about that. Men can do anything women can, and do it better, and do it with one hand tied behind their backs. When a woman strikes a man, she strikes all of society. Here's one from a poster campaign. I flipped the genders and the situation a little. Women can stop false allegations of abuse and rape. That's from a Men Can Stop Rape poster campaign that's all over campuses in the US and Canada. This is an especially wonderful one from UK Equalities Minister Harriet Harman. It cannot be assumed that women are bound to be an asset to family life, or that the presence of mothers in families is necessarily a means to social cohesion. Now, can you imagine a politician surviving on the podium for even a minute after they said that? But she said exactly that about fathers. Or how about this one? A mall roof caved in yesterday, killing 23 people and injuring more than 100. Tragically, 4 men and 1 child were among the dead. It just seems absurd. It seems absurd. And this one from 1600, right? The year 1600, published in a book by Lucrezia Marinella in Italy. It is an amazing thing to see in our city the husband of a laundress or a fishwife or a housemaid dressed in velvet with chains of gold at the throat, with silver buckles and boots of good value, and then in contrast to see his wife washing the clothes, chapped and bedraggled from the day's labor, poorly dressed. But whosoever considers this carefully will find it reasonable, because it is necessary that the gentleman, even if low-born and humble, be arrayed in such fine form for his natural excellence and dignity, and the woman be less adorned as if a slave or a little ass born to his service. Now, that was written about men by a woman and published in the year 1600. And you would never, ever get away with saying anything like that about women even now.
Wait a minute, I'm confused by the gender switching here.
This was with the gender switch. With the gender switch. She was talking about men being like a slave or an ass born to her service.
Interestingly, because in 1600 the men were very finely adorned.
They were, but we're talking, she was talking about the husbands of, the wives of porters or butchers. Right. Even they should be finely dressed for their natural dignity and excellence, even if humbly born. So these are statements you'd never really hear or read in mainstream culture, not even in the year 1600, some because they'd be repulsive to us, and others because it would just never occur to us to think or feel in that way. And that's all because of the way we as humans perceive and have always perceived men and women. And while feminism claims to have worked very hard to dismantle all of these individual and society-wide assumptions about men and women, if you scratch the surface of their ideologies and their efforts, what you mostly find is all of those assumptions human societies have always held, dialed up to 11.
You're with Truth News Australia. We're just going to break, and we've been playing you there a clip from Karen Strawn, investigating gender politics and radical feminism. Do stay with us. We'll be continuing with this after the break.
Another
welcome back. And today I'm bringing you some audio from a lecture given by Karen Strawn investigating radical feminism from a libertarian perspective and deconstructing some of the false logic. Very, very interesting talk. Highly recommend it. I hope you find it interesting too. I'll continue now with the talk by Karen Strawn.
Not only has feminist activism manipulated and exploited all of these age-old perceptions about gender for political, legal, economic, and social gain, it's only amplified them in the cultural zeitgeist. It's very much a case of say hello to the new boss, even more sexist than the old boss. Now, I've been asked before to sort of describe what it is I do. I do video lectures, I blog, I discuss things, I'm an activist. I am an advocate for the issues of men and boys, especially in the West, but I'm also an anti-feminist. And my task, as I see it, is to try to dig under the surface and uncover the real nature of things and maybe deprogram as many people as I can manage to do, to encourage them to think from a different angle, to entertain thoughts that are forbidden in our politically correct culture, to educate as many as I can about the hidden nature of society, gender, and especially ideological feminism. And among those of us who talk about these kinds of things, we call it taking the red pill. It represents a complete flipping of how you think about things. And why am I hoping to convince libertarians to think from that different angle? There's a strong libertarian streak that runs right down the center of the men's movement, and there's a reason for that. Canadian libertarian philosopher Stéphane Molyneux once called feminism socialism in panties. And I'm pretty sure most of the men here would be able to attest that anything, no matter how destructive or unprincipled, probably going to look more appealing and less sinister if it has a female face and you put it in some panties. So I'm not going to bore you with like a really detailed history of the marriage of feminism and Marxism. For that, I would refer any who are interested after the talk to a lengthy but fascinating lecture series by Soviet expatriate Valdis Analaskas, who describes the courtship between the two ideologies that began in the mid-1800s and has now become the foundation of feminist thought. I'll simply note that Karl Marx, in his Communist Manifesto, emphasized how very important women would be to any communist revolution, and that the best way to secure the support of women would be to convince them of the plural nature of their oppression. As workers, they were oppressed by the elites, and as women, they were oppressed by their husbands, fathers, and even sons. Though radical feminism has never severed its ties with Marxism and communism, as early as the 1920s, feminism had essentially co-opted and repurposed Marxist theory to describe the structure of society relating to the interaction of the sexes. The intellectual backlash against feminism that began within the Marxist community around the turn of the 20th century with E. Belfort Bax and Robert Refault was quashed through intimidation, censorship, and the use of emotionally charged propaganda. By the 1960s, when the Western world's love affair with communism had begun to fizzle, communism's red-headed stepdaughter, feminism, was only growing in popularity. The sexier, less threatening, more benign-seeming Trojan mare upon which Marxists had relied to sneak their ideology past the gates of the Western world had outgrown its helpmeet role and taken on a life of its own. By this era, a discrete and quintessentially Marxist theoretical model of gender had become entrenched in the intellectual sphere, a model based on class conflict theory and postmodern discourse. While communist thought was confined to a small pocket of what the mainstream mostly thought of as misguided weirdos, feminist thought, slapped together from the exact same bricks and mortar, became not only fashionable, but had spawned its own branch of academia, sponsored and enabled by unwitting democratic governments across the West. While historical views on the sexes had maintained that men and women were distinctly different but complementary partners, role mates, as Dr. Warren Farrell has described them, this new feminist model cast all aspects of society as oppressive and exploitive systems, wherein men embodied the bourgeoisie and women the proletariat. Most of this model, the patriarchy, and its sub-theories are little more than post-hoc rationalizations based on emotional reasoning, easily swallowed by the well-meaning public because of the evidence that stands out most starkly to us, given our natural evolved views of gender. Humans have always been more emotionally reactive to the harms, injuries, injustices, complaints, and perils that affect women, and more likely to see women as nurturing, benign, kind, well-meaning, and deserving of protection. We have always been more likely to see men as strong, sturdy, capable of self-sufficiency, potent, and potentially threatening. And those perceptions inform our reactions when men suffer harms, injuries, injustices, and dangers, and when they dare to complain about them. Because of these innate perceptions, when feminists pointed up toward the top of society and showed us mostly men, we didn't bother to direct our attention down to the bottom of society so we could see the mostly men there as well. We all saw a glass ceiling, but not a glass cellar, and allowed feminists to convince us that all aspects of society, the formalized and the informal, were male-dominated and male-controlled, and that women as a class were utterly powerless and subjugated under this system. Marriage was redefined under this model from a partnership where both parties contributed and benefited to a form of sexual slavery and unpaid drudgery for women, where wives were subjugated and exploited for their husbands' express benefit. Under second wave feminism, family was reinterpreted as an institution based on exploitation, instead of all members working together for the benefit and shared success of all members. Women were recast as powerless subordinates, providing unreciprocated labor toward the raising of his children and the keeping of his house. Labor that freed husbands to pursue economic and social power outside the home. It didn't matter that most men had little more access to economic and social power than most women, or that what power men achieved, they were expected to share equitably with their families. Feminists were too busy pointing upward at the congressmen, bank managers, and CEOs and crying injustice to show us the taxi drivers, garbage men, plumbers, loggers, fishermen, miners, construction workers, factory laborers, field workers, roughnecks, and janitors. They envied the power of generals and statesmen, but spared no thought for the thousands of young foot soldiers dead in trenches. They were jealous of the self-determination that made an industrialist rich beyond dreaming, but when that same self-determination produced a different outcome for the mostly male population of tramps, beggars, and hobos, it was invisible to them. They focused solely on the men above them and did not even notice the men below. The 23-cent average apples-to-oranges annual wage gap is still, in their minds, the height of sexist injustice, but the 94% workplace death gap, well, who cares? Traditional ways of providing for and protecting women that were necessary in the pre-industrial past were reinterpreted by feminism as male oppressors keeping women down all through history for men's benefit. Domestic violence, a social problem that has always been gender symmetrical, became synonymous with violence against women. A husband's historical right to conjugal relations was redefined as marital rape, while a wife's identical right, one that for centuries, if denied, was legal grounds for divorce and could even get a man excommunicated from his church, well, that part of history was erased from modern scholarship.
Hi, welcome back. Well, we're listening here to a lecture here by Karen Strawn, Deconstructing Radical Feminism. Really interesting stuff, really eye-opening, mind-opening, and challenging so many of the preconceptions that are sort of intrinsic, foundational to the sort of modern post-war society. It's not that, you know, far back in history that this has become so ingrained, but it certainly over the last 50 years or so has become the sort of unquestionable sine qua non of modern Western democracies, some of these presuppositions about feminism. And of course, behind that, some of the more extremist ideological positions continue to lurk in there. And of course, they lurk in the legal system, which has these travesties of justice with things like restraining orders, which I did a whole show on. Of course, in Australia, they're called apprehended violence orders, which completely subvert the normal rule of law and the presumption of innocence. But again, that's all based on this presumption that men are fundamentally bad, fundamentally dangerous. And of course, it's an incredibly effective way of disempowering men and, in fact, enslaving the whole of society. It all comes together. It all dovetails together. So we won't be able to bring you the whole presentation today, but I will continue with the rest of today's show with what we can fit in of the lecture, and I'll provide links to the full lecture in the notes for today's show on truthnews.com.au.
Well, that part of history was erased from modern scholarship, even as it is upheld and reinforced by feminist activism. In fact, according to current feminist theories on domestic violence, a man withholding sex or affection from his wife, whatever the reason, is committing domestic abuse. And incidentally, a man in France was recently ordered to pay $10,000 in punitive damages to his ex-wife for not giving her enough sex during their marriage. The traditional obligation of a woman to defer to her husband's authority was defined as oppression, but her husband's obligation to die in a trench to protect his country and his family, that was redefined as male privilege. And when enough people protested the hubris of that assertion, it became patriarchy hurts men too. Under the patriarchy, all men are privileged by their maleness, and all women oppressed by their femaleness. And if men are, as a class, the privileged bourgeoisie, if men hold collective power over society, then all men are culpable for the oppression and exploitation of all members of the female proletariat. This is collectivism at its finest. And any discrimination a man might face in society is just his own privilege backfiring on him. According to radical feminists, the drastic technological and economic changes that occurred during the last century or more, medical advances that virtually eliminated deaths in childbirth, drastically decreased infant and child mortality rates, changes that rendered the workplace as safe and comfortable as your living room, safe and reliable birth control, industrialization, automation, prosperity, plenty, and an unprecedented level of personal, individual, physical safety. None of this had anything to do with the gains women have made. Even prior to these changes, they said, during a history in which a woman might spend half her adult life pregnant or nursing children, where most labor was backbreaking, dangerous, and simply beyond the physical capabilities of women, where life was often brutal and brief, and where men bore a legally enforceable obligation to provide for the material needs of all family members, the fact that men bore economic authority along with all the economic burdens of a family was a system specifically designed to disempower women. According to radical feminists, your grandfathers and great-grandfathers were rapists and slave owners who exploited, subjugated, and violated the women who were nearest and dearest to them, their own wives, mothers, sisters, and daughters. According to radical feminists, every atrocity ever committed throughout all of history can be laid at the door of normal masculinity. Every male-generated advance, however, calculus, alternating current, the telegraph, the transistor, radio, penicillin, the number system, hydroelectricity, microwaves, fiberglass, the theory of relativity, the periodic table, trigonometry, insulin, canned foods, vaccines, fire retardant, Teflon, wireless communications, the microchip, the birth control pill, and even tampons. All of that is a result of men intentionally holding women back, keeping women down, refusing to allow women to achieve, and thereby hogging all the power and glory. You see how all that works. All the evils of history, committed mostly by men, are evidence of men's oppressive natures. And all the advances of civilization, because they have been generated almost exclusively by men, are equally evidence of men's oppressive natures. Even the exceptional and wonderful things men have given us that benefit us all, they are not evidence that men embody anything good. In fact, they demonstrate the opposite. They are evidence that the old boys' club modern feminists complain about today dates all the way back to the Pleistocene, when women would have eagerly hunted mastodon with babies strapped to their breasts and carved back a jungle filled with leopards and bears if only men had not enslaved them and thereby deprived them of an opportunity to do so. This is what they believe. This is what ideological feminism is, not coffee shop feminism, not the movement for political, social, and economic equality for women, but the belief system of ideological feminism. It describes women's experience through history as identical to the experience of blacks under slavery. You know, actual oppression. To clarify, what were the upsides to being black in America during slavery? Can anyone here name a single white slave owner who ever died to save the lives of his black slaves? Whoever gave up a space in a lifeboat to his black slave and chose himself to go down with a ship? Whoever stood with a rifle between his black slaves and an enemy to defend their lives rather than his right to own them? Can anyone even imagine a white slave owner working 16 hours in a field without sunscreen or bug spray, while his black slave stayed inside most of the day, kept his house tidy, fed his children, and then came home and shared the fruits of his labors with his black slave? Did a black woman who was the sexual partner of a white slave owner have any expectation of respect, lifelong provision, protection, or shelter, or of sharing the benefits of his quality of life and his social status? Or was she just an object of the moment, free to be used and cast aside at will? Did a black man who was obligated to obey his owner's wife have any legal right or recourse when she pointed a finger and claimed he raped her? Or was he swinging from a tree within hours? Can anyone imagine a reality where a white slave owner would perform physically grueling or dangerous work because his black slave was incapable of it? Or would he simply set more slaves to the task, or work his slave to death, or discard his used-up slave and buy a better one? If women were truly oppressed by men, would they have been spared the most onerous and dangerous work because they were less physically capable of it? Or would men have simply assigned more women to the task? Can anyone here name a single black person, man or woman, who rose to state-sanctioned power during slavery? Off the top of my head, I can name a whole bunch of women who have been heads of state going as far back as ancient Egypt. The greatest and most notable leaders emerging from Jim Crow America and apartheid South Africa rose to influence by opposing the government, not rising within it, because they had no avenue to power within a system that really oppressed them. Slavery and oppression are defined as obligation and disadvantage without compensatory benefit. Does anyone here think women, who were a tiny minority, tenths of a percent among the 10 million soldiers who died during World War I, derived no benefit from the traditional system? One of the few ways, in fact, a man could duck conscription was to be married. A man could avoid mandatory military service if his wife would be inconvenienced by it. And yet this system existed to benefit men at the expense of women, a system of top-down oppression, according to feminists, that is no different from the experience of blacks under slavery. And if you perceive history and gender relations as being remotely similar to the history of slavery in the U.S., it's no shock to hear feminist Robin Morgan, editor of Ms. Magazine, claim, Man-hating is an honorable and viable political act. The oppressed have a right to class hatred against their oppressors. Yet, as childish and simplistic and absurd as this model was, it wasn't long before it had become firmly entrenched in academia, in the humanities and the arts, in sociology, anthropology, psychology, history, women's studies, and gender studies, the very faculties and programs most associated with education, social work, journalism, the law, and political science, the very branches of society most able to influence public perception and with the greatest impact on people's lives. And because of all those things I was talking about at the beginning of this presentation, public perception was vulnerable to the half-truths presented to it that were disguised as the entire picture. And the really awesome thing about this model is that as long as enough people believe it, even just a little, as long as enough people can be convinced to see men as the bourgeoisie, who have always unjustly benefited from their exploitation of women, and women as the proletariat who have been forced to toil and slave without benefit under the boot heel of those privileged, oppressive men, you can justify anything.
And I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. Extremely interesting talk, and it goes on for quite a while. I do encourage you to grab it and have a listen. We'll be back next week with more incisive analysis and original material. So do stay tuned. I look forward to speaking to you then. Truth News Radio Australia signing out. Keep up the good fight. Remember that freedom depends on people like us to uphold it.